Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today centers around insurance, different kinds, home, auto, health. I know it's not the sexiest of subjects, but it truly affects all of us. And with the current record-setting wildfires, COVID-19 pandemic, and coming general election, there are potentially some major insurance changes either happening or coming soon as a result that will affect you. Coming up, we'll talk about efforts to give you another option for setting your auto insurance rates, and they're based on how you drive in real time. It's called telematics, and it's currently not legal in California, but some state lawmakers want to see that changed. Also ahead, new laws in California could strengthen mental health insurance in the state. But first, the fires consuming the forests of California are also damaging or destroying homes and businesses and a regional economy already weakened by the coronavirus outbreak. The destroyed property is running up huge losses for insurers, and even Governor Gavin Newsom says he expects current estimates to jump once we get a true assessment of what's been lost.
Still, Jesse, needs of 44,000 people that have been evacuated here in the state, and obviously concern about the over 4,200 structures that we know have been destroyed so far. And we say so far because when we get back in into these parts of the state where we haven't been able to actually assess the damage, we anticipate that structure damage to go significantly up.
Goes significantly up, he says there at the end. That was the governor at an evacuation center in Chico yesterday afternoon. The credit rating agency AM Best estimates that insured losses from this year's California fires could top the unprecedented $13 billion with a B recorded back in 2017 when the state was hit by three of the five costliest fires in U.S. history. Then 1 year after that was the record-setting Camp Wildfire in Butte County, the deadliest in state history, virtually wiping a town right off the map. So, with the frequency of destructive fires in California drastically affecting the bottom line for insurance companies, how much longer will they continue to offer coverage in areas deemed susceptible to a future blaze? Christopher Flavelle is a climate reporter at the New York Times and joins us today from Washington, D.C. to help us understand how this could play out. Welcome to Insight, Christopher. Let's start with, do insurance companies have the ability to turn down customers in these fire-prone areas?
So currently, there's a one-year moratorium in places hit by the 17-18 fires and in adjacent zip codes. And what that means is in those areas, insurers cannot non-renew. So at the end of your one-year contract, you can't get a note currently saying, yeah, we're going to stop covering you. What they are doing, what insurers are doing, is not writing new business. And the concern is that come December, when the one-year moratorium ends, they can also renew the process of non-renewing these customers. So come December, sort of all everything is free for insurers. They can do what they want.
And this is a December that follows what could be the worst fire season in California's history.
Yeah, I mean, when I talked to insurers earlier this year for these stories, they said that one of the big things they're watching, of course, is how bad this year is. And now this year has turned out to be very, very bad.
So for these people who either may not get to sign up with insurance or have their insurance not renewed, is there another option? Is there some other way to insure their home in case a wildfire comes through?
Yeah, the fallback option is the California FAIR Plan. And that is designed as an insurer of last resort, sort of a high-risk pool. It doesn't have a huge number of policies. I think the number, it's jumped a lot, but it's still, I think, sub 200,000 policies, but a high rate of growth. And that is part of what's sort of driving the concern. It's one important metric that the commissioner looks at and that customers look at to sort of get some sense of where it's going. And the fast growth in the FAIR Plan is one reason that we know that people are having a hard time getting private insurance.
And this is a state-run plan. And I would imagine you're only at high risk if you go into the plan. So that can't be the best possible solution, right? Because insurance works when you spread out the risk.
It's not great for homeowners because they pay higher premiums through the FAIR plan. There's limits on the kind of coverage and the amount of coverage you can get. It's also not great for the plan itself because they tend to have, as you said, high risk premium holders, policy holders. And so you get a lot of concentration in dangerous areas, which for any other insurance company is exactly what they don't want.
Uh-huh. We should note that we are in contact with Ricardo Lara's office. He's the state insurance commissioner. And as it stands right now, he's scheduled to join us briefly tomorrow morning with some top-level insight on how the state does plan to move forward on these issues that we're discussing. There may be some changes in the works here, so today was not the right day. Christopher, if insurers won't cover these areas and, you know, the state's insurance plan is just too expensive for some people, then what happens in these areas? People just don't build there anymore?
So I hate this phrase. We're sort of in uncharted waters, right? There's been versions of this scenario playing out, but with hurricane risk in Florida, it could go different ways, right? One way it goes is home values fall in these areas because insurance becomes more expensive. A more extreme version of how this could play out is people are less likely to build homes in the first place in these areas because they figure they'll get less money for them. I wouldn't be surprised if you get a significant flow continuing into the FAIR plan. I mean, people are living in these areas for a lot of reasons, right? It's not just the cost alone. It's a lifestyle. They're beautiful areas. I would imagine that there's going to be still significant demand, even if insurance becomes more expensive. The issue is going to be, what if insurance is effectively unavailable? If you get so many people flowing into the FAIR plan that the rates have to go way up, and then all of a sudden insurance that most people can afford is no longer available. It's a scary prospect. In reporting on this for some time now, I've never really heard someone say, here's plan B. Here's what we do if we get there. My sense is that it's one of those inherently tough situations where you could, in theory, just let the market work, right? Let the insurance company decide the risk, let them charge the rates they think they got to charge and see what happens. Nobody wants that outcome, right? Because that's just crushing on people who already live in these areas. And it's crushing on governments in these areas that depend on tax revenue from these homes, right? So I think no one's gunning for that outcome. But the question is, what can you do to avoid it being resolved that way, in a way that's more amenable? I mean, you hear really complicated proposals around, well, we can let insurance rates go up, but we can also help people who are low income, subsidize them, help them move if they want to. You know, the idea of buyouts in these areas used to seem sort of fanciful just a few years ago, but now it's being discussed. There was a poll at Stanford a few weeks ago showing some support for buyouts from.
And what would that involve?
So presumably it would, I mean, we don't know because it hasn't happened, but presumably it'd be some version of flood buyouts where you identify people who live in very, very risky areas. And you say, if you're willing to leave, we, the government, will buy your house and not let anyone else build there. But I mean, the cost of that would be astronomical. So again, everyone realizes there has to be a plan here. No one seems to know what it will be.
This comes at a time, Christopher, when people are leaving large cities and moving to vacation areas. We just on the show just yesterday, we talked about these Zoom towns, as they're called. Truckee near Lake Tahoe is a big one because, you know, people can work remotely and can live in these natural settings that they used to could only visit on vacation, right? But these are the very areas that are at risk for wildfire. And then on top of that, you have Governor Newsom, who came into office with a promise to build a lot more homes because California has an incredible housing shortage. So where do these homes get built? What is the state of home building in California right now?
Yeah. So when I talked to home builders earlier this summer, I asked them that question. I said, do we know if the immense fires of the last few years have dented that trajectory? And they said just the opposite. All indications are that the pace of home building in the so-called WUI, the fire-prone areas, is continuing.
And that's WUI. I'm sorry to stop you there. WUI stands for Wildland Urban Interface?
Exactly. Okay. Yes, exactly. It's not quite a popular term yet, but it will be. Yeah. And one home builder representative actually said the rate of demand to build in these fireproof areas has increased because of COVID. People are even more eager to get out of the cities. And if that means going into these fire-prone but beautiful areas, they're willing to do it. So it's not clear that the increasing risk has really changed behavior, at least not that we can tell.
So if insurance companies decide to completely pull the plug in these WUI areas, again, wildlands urban interface, it's where cities butt up against, you know, forest. I would imagine that the market would drop because, as you mentioned, it would just be too expensive for somebody to buy the home and pay their mortgage. And then on top of that, pay this exorbitant insurance fee. So home builders aren't going to want to put that risk up and build those homes if they can't sell them. So could insurance companies become the arbiters of where we build in California?
Yeah. And you know, at some sort of hypothetical level, that's almost how it should work, right? No one really has better information on risk in theory than insurance companies. And they don't really answer to voters. And so unlike politicians, they're not beholden to the sense of, well, you know, what does the public want? But I think there's a really legitimate concern that, again, if you leave it to insurance companies to decide which communities thrive and which are forced to shrink, there's a real fairness question, right? So again, I think the goal for at the state level is how do we avoid letting insurers make these decisions? And insurers don't want to, right? They don't see themselves as playing this role, but then what do you do? And I think we get to a point where politicians probably are forced to take steps that are not terribly popular, and they might use insurers as the bad guy and say, it's not us. We don't want to do this. We don't want to restrict development, impose tougher codes, what have you. But if we don't, insurers are just going to crush this market. So we have to. So there could be some sort of good cop, bad cop dynamic that happens. Mm-hmm. But again, the pressure, as you know, the pressure to grow the number of households in the state, to grow the housing stock, is so immense that it's not yet clear to me that even with these crazy fires that we're at the point that it'll be enough to diminish that pressure. I don't see a tipping point yet. But every big fire could be that tipping point.
And I wonder if it would be a tipping point for established neighborhoods as well. You know, when the Tubbs fire swept through Santa Rosa, it wiped out established neighborhoods. Some of these had been around for a really long time, like 100 years. Yeah. You know, this is Sonoma County is part of the Bay Area. So we're not talking about these far flung like WUI areas. So are areas considered at risk that weren't before in this changing climate? We have about a minute. So sorry to give you that with just a minute.
There's degrees of risk and the profile of risk is expanding. I think if you see change, you'll see it in these far flung areas where the risk is undisputable. That's where something will change first. I just don't know if we're even there yet. I think the established neighborhoods, they'll stick around because they've been home to so many for so long.
Mm-hmm. It's just, we just don't know what we're dealing with anymore, I guess, when it comes to, especially when you look at the fire year this year, which has really changed so many calculations.
Public appetite will change. We just won't know until it happens.
Yeah. Christopher Flavelle is a climate reporter at the New York Times, and you can find a link to his piece about the insurance issue in California at capradio.org/insight. Really enjoyed your piece with The Daily last week as well, Christopher. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And up next, will you be willing to let technology monitor how you drive, basically track you, if it could drastically lower your car insurance rates? Well, that option could be coming to California, and we'll speak with an expert who understands how it all works. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is on insurance and possible changes coming that could affect your rates and possibly whether you can get insurance at all. Next up is a look at car insurance in California, a state some people say was built on the automobile. There's a push right now by state lawmakers to add a new way to judge how much you pay in auto premiums. The method is called telematics, and it would use current technology to monitor or maybe even track your driving behavior. According to California Assembly members Evan Lowe and Autumn Burke, both Democrats who wrote a commentary for CalMatters, the use of telematics would modernize the system. Unfortunately, they say, California is the only state that prohibits this kind of technology because of something called Proposition 103. So it was written and passed back in 1988 with the goal of protecting consumers, lowering costs, and creating a better insurance market. So both Lowe and Burke say it's been successful in doing that. But when the law was passed in 1988, the internet, at least as we know it, didn't exist, nor were modern cell phones, GPS navigation, and many other advancements that we now just take as a part of everyday life. They say the law doesn't allow companies to rate customers on their driving behavior. So Prop 103 relies heavily on demographic factors rather than basing your rate on how you actually drive. So for a better understanding of telematics and how the system works in other states, Jason Metz joins us from his home in Massachusetts. He's an insurance analyst for Forbes Advisor. Jason, thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So when we talk about monitoring our driving or tracking us, what does that entail exactly?
So basically, it sounds exactly like that. You would be tracked. Your driving behaviors, most notably your speeding, your acceleration, harsh braking, meaning coming to those hard stops, like when you misjudge coming up on a stop sign or in a line of traffic, cornering, miles driven.
So cornering, like sharp turns?
Sharp turns, exactly. Uh-huh. The time of day you drive, and if you use your phone while you drive, all those kind of driving behaviors could potentially be tracked depending on the device that you're using.
So if you use your phone while you drive, like distracted driving.
Exactly.
Yeah. How would they know any of those things are happening?
Okay, so depending on the insurance company that you use, there's typically four ways that these behaviors would be tracked. One way would be through a system like OnStar or BMW Connected Drive. That's
something
already
built into your car.
Mm-hmm. Built into your system. A second would be a device that's plugged into your car's onboard diagnostics port, which is like to the left of the steering wheel in most cars. Another would be a device that is attached typically to your rearview mirror that works through Bluetooth. And then a third would be through a mobile app on your phone. And that for sure would be able to track when you pick up and use your phone for distracted driving.
So I guess if you use the phone version, you could be in anyone's car and they might not be driving all that well. And the insurance company doesn't know that you're not the one behind the wheel.
Yeah, that's true. I had used third-party apps in the past to test my driving, and it would score you based out of 100, 100 being a perfect drive. And, you know, the worse you drive, the lower you score. And sometimes I would check my statistics, and I was getting scored for being a passenger in my friend's car who had a lot heavier foot than I usually do. So that is something that you should be aware of if you use a telematics program that tracks you through your phone.
Especially, you know, someone who may not drive very often at all, which would be one of the reasons to go this route, right? Like you hardly ever drive. And then, but be, because you don't hardly ever drive, you might use Lyft or Uber or any of the, you know, different services that might not show up so favorably as you just mentioned.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I forgot about that, but there's been times that I've been scored on my Lyft driver's driving.
Right. So when you buy insurance, are you buying it for the car or are you buying it for the driver? How does that work exactly?
Well, when you buy insurance, your car is factored into the rates. You know, if you, certain cars are considered less risky as opposed to, you know, a sports car or a more expensive car, you're going to pay more typically because it costs more to repair. But your driving history is factored into your premium rates, regardless of tracking behaviors. You know, if you have a history of speeding tickets, traffic violations, of at-fault car accidents, you're typically going to pay more. So a program like telematics, which is called usage-based insurance, can help lower cost if you are a safe driver, if you don't speed, if you don't brake harsh, if you don't use your phone. That can help lower your costs in addition to having a safe driving record already established.
Yeah, and the lawmakers that I mentioned off the top of the show, they say that rating on driving behaviors is more fair, but they also say it can help make the roads safer. And they point out the distracted driving portion of that that you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, distracted driving is at this point an epidemic. And I don't have stats in front of me, but that's obviously become a major issue in the last decade. So there is some evidence to show that rewarding people for better driving behaviors can make the road safer. Of course, I guess it's also safe to point out that when you sign up for a usage-based insurance program, there's typically an evaluation period, right? Where you, whatever device you use, whether it's through your car's ODB port or your phone, you're going to be evaluated for your driving behaviors for sometimes up to 4 to 6 months. And then your premium is set or you get a discount based upon how you score. Now, I guess an argument would be from a safety standpoint is that you could drive really great for 4 to 6 months. And once you get that discount, you could kind of go back to some old habits. So it's not a fail-proof way of making roads safer.
Can it do the opposite? Can it increase your rates if you're not, you know, you're doing a lot of hard turns and hard braking and jackrabbit starts and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's going to depend on your insurance company. Some insurance companies, for example, I believe Travelers will actually increase your rates if your scores go down, if you're not exhibiting safe driving behaviors. Other company webpages say that your rates will not increase. So that's from a consumer standpoint, before you sign up for any program, you really want to understand how this could impact your premium rates.
So if California were to adopt this, change the rules so that the state could use this method, it's not necessarily evenly distributed among the insurance companies. The insurance companies can take this and use it as a tool however they like? Or at least that's how it works in other states?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that would fall under each state's regulations, how it could affect premium. It would need to be approved by the insurance regulation. That I can't say for sure.
Yeah. Jason, if you wanted to go this route, but you didn't necessarily want to be tracked everywhere you go, is there some sort of in-between ground?
Are you saying if you...
You know, like if you... You want to use this UBI, but you don't want to commit to your insurance company tracking your driving behaviors just yet. What can you do?
I understand. So you can Google safe driving apps, and a handful will come up, and you can use it through your phone. And you could give yourself kind of a test period to see how you're driving. I think one thing that as humans we tend to do is we're a little bit overconfident in ourselves and don't trust others. You know what I mean? Like everybody else is an awful driver, but you never are.
Right. We rate ourselves better.
A maniac. Yeah. But you know, if you're driving on the highway and you're keeping pace in the left lane and going with the flow of traffic, chances are you're going over the speed limit, which is going to be scored against you. And that, if that's your daily habit to be commuting and keeping up with the flow of traffic, chances are you're not going to score well in terms of speeding, which could impact your insurance rates. So I would recommend that you really take a hard look at your driving habits and how you might score in the eyes of an insurance company, not your own estimation.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people listening right now in their car. That's terrestrial radio still is king in the car. And so if you're listening and you're driving right now, look down at your speedometer. Is that the speed limit? Because it would be just 1 mile over, right? And the company would ding you. Do you know if they ding you based on the number of miles over the speed limit, or it's just that you were going over?
Where that number lies, I can't speak to. I mean, each insurance company would, and the programs they use would kind of have their own, let's say, a little bit of cushion. But you know, generally, I think they would see it. Speeding is speeding. I don't think if the speed limit is 65, you go 66, I don't think they're going to crush you. But if the speed limit is 65 and you're going 75, 80, you're definitely going to get hit for that.
Yeah. How about consumer privacy? This is one of the big issues. You talked about the device that you can plug into the car. I put one of those in my car as part of a trial program from the state of California because the state is trying to figure out how to pay for the roads, because as efficiency of cars rises, and in some cases you don't buy gasoline at all because they're electric cars, the state pays for the roads via gas tax. And if people are buying less gas or no gas at all, those funds aren't coming in, but the roads are still being used. So they had this program a couple of years ago where they wanted to see how well it would work if cars were tracked. So I volunteered for it, and I had this thing that I plugged into my car, and I think it might be really similar to what you're talking about, because it did, you know, look at everywhere where I was going. I'm not sure how much it paid attention to. Oh, you know what? It did, now that I think about it. The app did tell me about speeding and those sorts of things. And so a lot of people might be not willing to plug something like that into their car, worried about their privacy rights. Same with an app on the phone or that sort of thing. So what do we know about consumer privacy related to this type of tracking for insurance companies?
That I would say that you really would need to read the fine print of what your insurance company. I mean, obviously, if you want to participate in that program, you're allowing the insurance company on some level to access that data. I mean, that data is going to show where you've been, when you started driving, when you stopped driving. It'll know all the locations you've been to, the time of day. If you're uncomfortable sharing that kind of data with your insurance company, I would recommend not participating in this kind of program.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you are comfortable with it, it might be able to land you up to a 40% discount depending on your insurance company.
So I should note again that telematics is not currently available in California because of a proposition that was passed back in 1988, but the California Department of Insurance is initiating conversation on telematics with various stakeholders. So since it's not available here yet, Jason, and we happen to have the ear of an insurance analyst expert. do you mind if I ask you, let's say you're a safe driver, but you can't participate in this UBI type program. What are some other ways that Californians could save right now on their insurance?
Call your insurance agent and ask about discounts for safe driving. Insurance companies, theoretically, they love safe drivers. You're lower at risk, and it starts with not getting speeding tickets, not getting moving violations, and not causing accidents. If you can establish a safe driving history, you are generally going to pay less across the board. And in some cases, you might not even need to participate in a program like this because you already have a safe driving history. And different insurance companies have different ways they reward this. And that's also where you can shop around with insurance companies and find out who rewards safe drivers.
Sometimes it just pays to pick up the phone, right? Jason Metz is an insurance analyst for Forbes Advisor. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
And still ahead, new California laws are aimed at strengthening mental health insurance in the state. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And recently, California's legislature passed one of the nation's strictest mental health parity bills. It aims to increase mental health insurance coverage to include far more conditions, including addiction, as well as redefining the criteria for insurance denials. As NPR reported earlier this month, patient advocates say the changes are needed because previous laws haven't gone far enough, because they permit insurance companies to pay for care only after the mental illness has reached a late-stage crisis. In some cases, they let companies deny coverage outright. Sammy Caola is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter and joins us now to help us understand where California now sits with these issues. And it's always great to have you here, Sammy.
Good morning, Randall. Thanks for having me.
So help us understand. I do not understand healthcare insurance at all, and then bring it into under the mental health umbrella. Mental health parity, what does that mean?
It's not too complicated, actually. The word parity just means equal coverage. It means anything that you're supposed to get for your physical well-being, you should get the same thing for your mental well-being. And that includes if you have substance use issues. So, you know, if you have cancer and you have all of these screenings and pre-meetings and consultations for your cancer and then cancer surgery, in the same vein, if you have a mental health condition that's been diagnosed, you should get all of that, intermediary care, initial care, follow-through care. And in our health system right now, it's not really happening that way. And so parity just refers to this sort of legal obligation that insurers provide equal coverage. And it's documented. It's been California law since 1999. It's been federal law since 2008, and then was improved federally in 2014. But advocates behind the bill you referenced just say it's just not happening. Insurers are just not following.
And when you talk about parity with healthcare, my healthcare provider might do some things for me in terms of preventative care, like to help keep me from getting sick, and those things would be covered. Would that also then, if we did have this true parity, extend to mental health, things to help keep you from worsening a mental health condition?
I believe that's the ideal. That's what advocates would like to see, is a full spectrum of covered mental health care, including those sort of preventive wellness services. Mm-hmm. Right now, advocates say insurance companies are doing sort of the bare minimum. They're doing, as you said, the crisis intervention. And California's parity law actually only covers 9 specific mental illnesses. Mm. So if you don't have one of those 9 diagnosed conditions, your insurance company can deny you under California law. And so that's one of the major goals of the bill that's now on the governor's desk, is to get that coverage to be more widespread, right? So that we can catch people earlier. And as you said, Randall, I think during the pandemic, this is vital. You know, without reliable, affordable access to mental health care, people who are, you know, maybe never struggled with mental health before, but they're struggling now because of COVID-19. They may have a hard time setting up an appointment, you know, depending on who their insurer is. Or somebody who had a diagnosed condition that maybe they were managing well, perhaps they're not managing it as well under these difficult circumstances. And so it does seem like a crucial time to be looking at this.
I think those of us who even feel, like their mental health is pretty solid, are feeling that being pushed to the limits right now, when you have this layering of one crisis after another. It just really strikes me, Sammy, when you pointed out equal coverage only covers 9 mental health conditions, I would imagine, you know, once again, I'm not really familiar with this topic, but I imagine there's far more than 9 conditions, right?
There are many more than 9 conditions, yeah. And it covers what people might think of the most common ones, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective, some of the eating disorders. But, you know, there are so many more. And there are more mental health ailments that we're discovering every day. You know, there's so much research happening, and we're really just coming around in medicine to acknowledging mental health on the same level that we acknowledge physical care. And so we're behind because of the stigma, I think, around mental illness for a long time. People were not looking at it as right. Something that was treatable and something that could help and something where people could still function, right? And obviously we can. Lots of people succeed very well when they're in the proper care. And so, you know, it's this insurance debate, I think, really brings us to a point of acknowledging mental health in our society and just trying to bring it up to par. You know, when someone goes to the hospital with a broken leg, you don't say, oh, you'll be fine, go home.
It'll heal.
You'll heal. Right? Right. In the same way that if somebody comes and says, I'm struggling, you know, with depression or anxiety or anything else, I think a lot of advocates say we need to treat that from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. How does California differ from other states when it comes to that perception? You mentioned that there are federal parity laws that have been updated again as recently as 2014. Is California a leader in this area, or how does it work?
That's a good question, Randall. I truly have not looked into too many other policies in other states, but I think it's fair to say that we're certainly ahead of the game in sentiment. I think this push that you hear in California around mental health is pretty unique. We've got really strong sort of grassroots mental health advocacy organizations that have been pushing for this for a long time. If you look at Proposition 63, the Mental Health Services Act, there is a ton of activism and policy making around that. That's basically state money that's specially siphoned off for mental health. And there's been a huge push to get that to be used for preventive care and other gaps in the system. If this bill that's on Governor Newsom's desk is signed, I believe it would be one of the strongest in the nation on parity.
So we're at the point right now where the legislature passed it, but it's not one of the bills that have been signed yet. And the governor has until what, the end of the month?
I believe that's right. You have to double check with our politics report.
I know. Nicole Nixon is just in the other room. Maybe she can let us know. But I understand, I think until the end of the month. And then if he doesn't take action, well, I shouldn't wade into those waters, because like you, Sammy, I'm not sure how that works exactly.
I will say, I know this is not the first time a parity bill has come up. Mm-hmm. Senator Jim Beal is the author of this bill. He has tried a couple of times and gotten pretty close, but never actually gotten it signed that I know of. So this would be pretty huge if this goes through.
Uh-huh. So solutions wise, we have these bills before us. What else might help the situation?
Well, you know, the bill is really a big one, because when it comes down to it, this is a pocketbook issue. You know, if you can't get covered for this care, you're probably not going to go seek it out. It's already hard for a lot of people to seek out mental health care. And if they think they're going to be in a battle with their insurance company over it, it's just another reason not to try. Mm-hmm. And there was this consulting group in California that found that people are more than 5 times likely to have office visits for mental health that fall outside of their insurance plan's network than if you're seeking medical or surgical care. Wow. So basically the networks are very slim. So that's something we would need to look at, right? Is like, okay, so say insurance is going to cover it. Are there enough providers? You know, California has a real shortage of mental health providers as well. And there's actually another bill, and I'm not positive on the status of this bill, but it would create what they'd call a peer mental health workforce. So people with lived experience with mental illness who are sort of there just someone to talk to, someone to take you to appointments, someone to help you with your medication, and they would get some training, they'd actually get certified, and then their services would be billable to insurance. And that's been something that's been in the works for a long time. So I'll keep an eye on that as well. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to this parity issue, you know, I talked to a clinical psychologist. His name is Ben Miller. He works for a mental health group called the Wellbeing Trust. And here is how he describes the significance of this bill.
A lot of times people would have claims denied because they weren't medically necessary. And what this bill does is it forces a clear determination based upon the evidence and the agreed upon standard or best practice for that treatment. So it makes it a lot harder for somebody to say, nope, that's not going to work for us today. We're not going to pay that. So that immediately will have an impact on folks' pocketbooks.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that just clarifies it. Just listening to him explain it right there made it clear to me.
Yeah, it's just going to give you more ground to stand on. You know, if you do find you're being denied, this law would give you something more firm to point to and say, hey, like you actually do have to cover this.
Right.
And we've seen legal battles play out around this before. Last year, there was a federal judge in Northern California who ruled that United Health was unfairly rejecting claims from tens of thousands of people who were seeking coverage for mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And so that was kind of the big, the big door opener, the big success, you know, when this judge ruled that actually, no, like you are going to have to cover this.
Sammy, you've covered mental health issues for a long time now. And I'm wondering if you have gained some sense as to why mental health is looked at so differently from just general health care. And why is it not just part of general health care? Why is it this separate category?
I think there's just been a long history in California and honestly in the whole United States of putting mental health into a different box and putting it in this sort of taboo, stigmatized place. And that traces back to when we had asylums and, sort of psychiatric institutions that people would argue took away really important human rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people with mental illness were not seen as being able to live, you know, lives out in the world. And so, you know, since California has really tried to dial back institutionalization, you know, there were major efforts in the 90s to get people out of institutions and into the community. But when that shift happened, there wasn't necessarily the structure in place for community assistance, right? We said people could, you know, live on their own, but maybe we didn't give them the care that they needed, the regular visitations. There's been, you know, you asked about solutions before. There's been a lot of talk about supportive housing. So places you can live 24/7 with somebody on staff who can help you.
Yeah.
Right. And so we might see that happen in the next couple of years.
Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Kaola, on a new bill that could be signed into law on mental health parity in our healthcare system. Sammy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Randall.
And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, digital team Chris Hagan, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas, technical director Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez, Insight's managing editor Aram Sarkissian, and Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And as always, we thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll catch you right back here tomorrow morning.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.